Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, and thank you for listening to Radio Itahuka. I'm Jennifer Feuerberg, your host for tonight's show, and our guest tonight is Dr. Theogene Rudisingler. Good evening, Dr. Rudisingler. It's an honor to speak with you.
Good evening, Jennifer. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Good.
Good. Tonight we'll be discussing Dr. Rudisingler's recently published book, Healing a Nation, A Testimony, Waging and Winning a Peaceful Revolution to Unite and Heal a Broken Rwanda. Please call in with your questions at 347-945-6449 or email them at radioitahuka@gmail.com. Well, Dr. Rudisingler, it's a pleasure to speak with you tonight, and I just wanted to start off with some current events that are going on. As we know, Rwanda Day is happening now in London, and I'm just wanting to, we participated in one of these events in Boston. I'm assuming it's the same, a similar type of event. But can you tell our listeners why Kagame holds these events and what is the purpose of them?
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. The Rwanda Day events, as you know, are events that the Kigali regime tries to host in order to, number one, demonstrate to the international community, but most importantly, to the Rwandan community in these countries, that the Kigali regime is popular, that President Kagame is a popular leader who is loved by his people, and that the Rwandans in diaspora are united behind him. But the sometimes also the not so stated objective of these meetings is actually a way of driving divisions amongst the Rwandans in diaspora, because it's a way of mobilizing them against the opposition in diaspora. And in fact, these events have become more pronounced in the last 2 years since the founding of RNC. And so Rwanda Day is part of it, really, to mobilize these Rwandans in diaspora against the opposition, particularly Rwanda National Congress and its partners FDU and other opposition groups. And so this is essentially the intention of these Rwanda Day proceedings.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that was one of the reasons that Kagame is having these events, or in opposition to the RNC. That's interesting.
It is because in the run-up to these Rwanda Day events, the regime really invests a lot of money into the process. It sends its envoys to all these communities. It uses money to buy people into coming to these events. It normally, you know, provides lots of food, lots of alcohol, and sometimes incentives, monetary incentives. It's only recently because of the reduction in the funds that come from outside through aid, that the regime has somehow, decreased the amounts of money that it tries to dispense to people as a motivation for them to attend these types of events. But generally, they provide hotels, they provide buses to shuttle people. In this case, in London, they have provided money to shuttle people across Europe. So it's both, a showcase to try and say, oh, look, the Rwandan people are united behind their dear leader. But it's also a way of trying to galvanize support against the opposition.
Are these events at all fundraising ventures? I know in Boston it seemed that they were raising some Agaturo funds. Are they doing the same in London, to your knowledge?
I'm sure they will. They will. It's become one of the themes of these events. I'm sure they want to tell people that, look, the international parts of the international community has decreased its funding to our national development budget, and so who cares? I mean, that has been the attitude of Kigali. Who cares? We Rwandans will do it ourselves. And so please rise to the occasion and support your own country. So they try to, you know, speak to, you know, some element of patriotism in order to mobilize funding for these types of events.
Okay. Interesting. The RNC should hold a Rwanda Day.
Yes, we in future we will hold a genuine, we should actually, that's a very good idea, Jennifer, we should try to mobilize in future and hold a genuinely Rwanda Day in which we can at least call upon Rwandans who participate to speak openly and freely about the conditions of our country. But also why we should be mobilized to create the future for our children and our grandchildren. So
I
you're
agree.
Absolutely right. I think that's an idea that we should develop.
Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed with the protesters and the organizing that's going on in London. It appears that there's a large number of people, including a large group of Congolese, that are planning to attend the protest. And it's been interesting to watch how they have changed venues, have venues have canceled on them, and now they're trying to keep the venue a secret until tomorrow, but it's already out there. We all know where it is. I don't recall in Boston them having quite this much trouble, but it seems that maybe in London they're a little more organized as far as getting the word out and getting protesters rallied together. There's been a very impressive effort, and I look forward to seeing tomorrow the pictures from the event and who was able to attend and all. That was good.
Yes, when me too. We certainly always look forward to see how the Rwandan people, especially in partnership with our neighbors, the Congolese people, the Burundians, in most cases, do also attend these types of events. But also shows that it's no longer simply exclusively a Rwandan issue. It's also a regional issue because the regime in Kigali poses the greatest threat to Rwandans, but it also poses a threat to our neighbors. So increasingly, I think looking at how we are mobilizing together with our dear brothers and sisters in the region is a very good sign that, you know, people are waking to the reality that, you know, the Kagame regime is not a problem to Rwandans alone. It's also a problem to the region.
Mm-hmm. I agree. All right. Well, let's get into the topic of our interview tonight, your book, Healing a Nation. I have read the book cover to cover. Despite its daunting size of 500 pages, it was a very fast read, very interesting book. And I have to say, I think I communicated with you about halfway through the book that I really couldn't put it down. I found it very interesting. And I think a lot of people are going to want to read this book. And hear your testimony and your experiences. I think having interviewed you a few times over the years, I get a lot of questions from people about you as if they think that you and I are very close friends and I can answer questions for you. And I can't do that. But I think that many people are going to find answers to those questions in this book. So I want to know, my first question is, where did the title of this book come from and who is the intended audience of this book?
That's a very good question. First of all, let me tell you that this book has taken me a long, long time to write. I, in fact, started the project itself almost 8 years ago when I left Rwanda for the first time in 2004. I'm sure you must have read it under the pretext that I was going out for 1 year on a sabbatical. That's what I told President Kagame for the first time, and that's what's on the records in the system. And then, of course, what for 2005. But when I first left, I started the book project, and when I later on looked at the manuscript, I had more or less left Rwanda, but I wasn't so sure that I'd completely left RPF. Because when I read it, I realized that I'd written like a cadre of the RPF. And so I abandoned the first manuscript, and I tried the second one in 2006-07, and I realized there was a lot of anger and frustration. I had clearly parted from RPF, but again, the tone of the book was one of anger rather than one of self-reflection, and trying to think about what you think your journey has been and how you think the future is like. So it has taken me a long time. This was the third round that I tried to do that. So the title really is something that has evolved over time, but I try to think, if there was one problem that Rwanda had, how would I summarize it, especially with a background like mine of heading from the medical profession? So I thought that our society, it's not only the government that is sick, it's actually society as a whole that is sick. And I think all members of society have inflicted damage on each other. The state has been the principal culprit, inflicting damage on society as a whole. But I thought that probably healing should be the appropriate title, because that's what all of us Rwandans are yearning for. That's what we are all craving for. And I think that's the theme that I wanted to be reflected in the title.
Okay. In your book, you write about your experiences as a refugee early in life and then again later in life. Your mother, as you wrote in the book, was the rock and the foundation of the family. As I read the book, that's how I interpreted her character. And she seems like quite an amazing woman, I may add. How has your experience been different the second time around, with you being the head of the family now and now also having to live as a refugee again?
Yeah, actually, the good question again. I think being a refugee itself is a phenomenon that is very difficult to describe to somebody like you or to people who've never gone through it. But anybody who has been a refugee, who's been in exile, would quickly understand it. But the first time around, I was a baby. I was a kid, and the challenge was essential to my mother, who, rightly so, as you describe, and as I describe in the book, really is the person that, in my formative years, was very instrumental not only in my education, but simply in day-to-day survival. Had it not been for the efforts of my mother, or the discipline of my mother insisting that I take serious my education, I do not think that I would have gone far in life. But the second time around, being a refugee, as I have described in the book, to a certain extent, it's self-imposed, because I decided that I could no longer be part of the system. And the system being what it is, being vicious as it is, being so intolerant, it's very difficult, especially for somebody who has served at the level that I served, to dissent from the system and remain within Rwanda, because the stakes are extremely high. The possibility of death is very high. The possibility of being incarcerated like many other people is very high, or disappearing, or simply being redundant, because you cannot imagine how many people in Rwanda today, people that we know of, who cannot live but who are not even employed by government, simply because the regime does not want them to live. So I would say that I chose to go into exile, because I felt that at least at some point I would be able to speak out against what I consider to be the injustice in Rwanda. So this time around, although itself I went into exile through choice, it is because also of the persecution that takes place within the country for those who do not who have dissenting voices from what is the official line of the RPF. But we should also know that there are so many people who are refugees. There are so many people who are fled persecution within Rwanda. And so, yes, there are two periods of my life, having been a refugee in the first part, the larger part of my life, and now for almost 8 years. Being a refugee is being a refugee. If you're in exile, you're in exile. But I think the types of challenges that I faced in the first part of being a refugee are to some extent different from the second part, because from the second part also, although later in the first part I was part of the movement to end the refugee situation, so the RPF in the second part also being a refugee, I'm also part of the effort to see how we can end this endless cycle of Rwandans becoming refugees time and again. So there are some similarities between the two periods, but there are also important differences.
Thank you. With your experience both in exile and as a politician, how do you feel about the Rwanda cessation clause that's set to go in effect in about 6 weeks?
It's really very absurd. Very, very absurd, and I think the Kigali regime, if it had any motivation or any inclination to listen, it should be listening to the protest of Rwandans who say, Rwandans love their country. I've not yet, and you know this, Jennifer, you can ask. I'm sure when you talk to Rwandans in the opposition or Rwandans who work for the Kigali regime, you have no doubt whatsoever that Rwandans tend to passionately love their country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, for people who are refugees to be coerced into returning to Rwanda, the motivation cannot be that the regime loves these Rwandans. It knows that these are people who are in exile against their wishes, because if the conditions in the country were favorable, you don't need to do a lot of convincing for people to go back home. But that being the case, the Kigali regime wants to give the impression that everything is okay within the country and that all refugees, Rwandan refugees, should go back home. And I think if anyone knows the conditions in Rwanda, the closure of the political space, the incarceration of opposition leaders, and remember most of the refugees are actually Hutus, and most of their leaders who tried to go back to Rwanda and create conditions in which these people would return have been put in jail, others have been killed. Journalists have been either killed or thrown into or forced into exile. This hunting down of opponents in exile continues. Assassination attempts continues. And then there is a whole climate of fear within the country. Everyone knows about this. And yet, the regime would try to create the impression that everything is okay and refugees must go back home. Now, if the regime was sensible, it would listen to the plight of the citizens within the country. It would create conditions in which the people within the country would be telling their relatives and friends that please come back home, everything is okay. But that is not the case. It's not listening. It's simply trying to manipulate the international system to have everyone go back home. And so I think the consequences of pushing this aggressive line of manipulating the international system and forcing people to go back home is one that is likely to produce, to tip Rwanda into another crisis, which in the worst case scenario might create conditions like the ones of 1990s when we had the civil war and what followed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mentioned a minute ago about how your mother was the foundation of your family. Her strength and determination were quite well versed in your book. Where did that come from inside of her, and where did her drive and focus on her children, making sure they were educated, where did that drive for her come from?
I think it's, number one, it's I would say that it's a mother instinct first and foremost, and I think we do see this kind of motivation and this kind of instinct throughout history, and not only amongst African women, but amongst women in general. I'm sure you know, you being a good student of history and the characters in history, both in time and space, you know that all these women have tended to be the bedrock on which most of the people who become successful in life, I'm not describing myself, but I'm simply saying that people who've gone to make major contributions in life have also tended to have mothers that have been very, very instrumental, especially in the formative years. So I would say it's a general mother instinct. Number two, it's an African woman kind of thing, because African women carry disproportionate burdens. Not only, I think it was once described very eloquently by Professor Ari Mazri, one of the distinguished African scholars, that you know, women generally are, you know, they are the ones who go to fetch water, they are the ones who go to fetch firewood, they are the ones who are at the backbone of the family economic system or the community economic system. They're the ones who tend to the kids. So I think it's really also an African woman thing. Number three, I think my mother was also uniquely very Christian, a Roman Catholic, and she therefore approached the matters of life with a lot of faith and with a lot of hard work. So faithful, hardworking, a mother instinct, an African woman. And I think particularly she was, as I described in the book, she had survival lessons that ensured that many of the health conditions that tended to take away many of my peers, that she somehow insulated us against those, like I described, you know, the habit of insisting that you must drink boiled water. If you don't, you must be spanked. And I described how I was, you know, one who was bound to be spanked more than my other siblings, or even insisting that you were making decisions about nutrition, how to grow your own food after the UNHCR decided abruptly to cut off the tap, and of course insisting on education. All these are things that she did essentially because also she was a very faithful and very wise woman. She's an African woman, but she has generally a mother instinct.
You discussed at length your life in those early years in Uganda and in different refugee camps. And you made a statement in the book, and I quote it. It says, "This life colors the dreams of children brought up in these conditions." Can you explain what you meant by that?
You know, Jennifer, I'm sure if in another interview I should interview you too. So we are going to switch roles at some point. I'm sure there are dreams that you've had that were colored by where you grew up, the conditions that you grew up in, your family, your community, overall being an American child, you know, the school that you attended to, what your peers were, the concerns of your peers. So even for somebody who grew up in that Orchinga refugee camp, you remember I described how my early dreams were colored by, these tractors that were part of the control of this fly, they call it the tsetse fly, that causes sleeping sickness. And those tractors that I was seeing for the first time, and the guy who was driving them, I found it so cool that actually the first dream in my life was to be a tractor driver. And then, of course, I later on saw the bus, the one bus, and the one pickup that slowly drove at snail speed through the village every morning and every evening. I also saw the drivers of these vehicles to be very cool people. So I also entertained the idea that maybe one day I would be a driver of a bus or a driver of a pickup. And, of course, there were other dreams that I entertained that, at that point, simply because of the kind of conditions that one grows up in. And one story which I'm sure you found very funny was my encounter with Coca-Cola. If you remember very well, I tasted, three sips from one of my relatives, an age mate, gave me to take a sip of Coca-Cola, and, lo and behold, it was quite a taste. And for a long time, I used to say, oh, my God, one of my dreams would be that one time I should be able to buy myself a Coca-Cola. And later on in life, indeed, when I was ambassador in Washington, D.C., I used to keep a crate of Coca-Cola in my office, which was testimony that then I could afford to buy myself a Coca-Cola, which was not a particularly healthy habit. And I've since stopped. I no longer keep crates of Coca-Cola, and I now try to fight wars with my own children, who also would love to have sips of Coca-Cola. And very often I have to yield and actually allow them to have Coca-Cola, because if you remember in the story, I mentioned somebody who I once watched, a relative of mine, much older than myself, who took Coca-Cola and never allowed me to have a sip, and I never forgave him. So these days I'm in the same position when my children tend to beg for Coca-Cola. Sometimes I yield and allow them once in a while to have Coca-Cola. So these are the kind of dreams that you have as a kid, and they are particularly colored by the events, the circumstances, and the people that are around you. And that's very important to know, because we often tell our children these days that beware of your dreams, because you might end up actually being what you dream about. So it's very important to create dreams that would allow our children also to dream about big things. But guess what? Children are children, whether they are Americans or Africans. At that kind of stage, you have all these cute and very silly dreams, but they are dreams still.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the Marxist influences in your early years of college and how you studied Marxism. How did his teachings, how do his teachings still influence you now in your personal and political career, and how is that different from when you were an active member of the RPF under Kagame?
Yeah, that's a very good question, one which probably would have an interview on its own, because it's a very foundational issue. As I said in the book, I described two major works that really influenced my thinking about society and about politics. And these two books were one by Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, and the other one, of course, was How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. So these were the type of works that I read as early on as a medical student when I went to Makerere University. And those were even the pre-Marxist years. I had not even yet discovered Karl Marx. And so these were very foundational, and the people who had also read the same books, who had been influenced by the same books, are the same leaders who later on were to lead the revolution in Uganda, notably President Museveni and his contemporaries, the Kategayas and many other people who later on became part of the ruling, who are part of the ruling establishment in Uganda today. And then, of course, later on, I in Nairobi, I got introduced to Marxist philosophy and its teachings and the revolutionary theory and so on and so forth. I think I do not regret it. I think at that point in one's youthful years, especially with injustice in society, Marxist philosophy tends to have an explanation. My major problem, later I would say what my critique about it would be, it tends to have an explanation and a scientific explanation to what you see around you. And so I think at that early stage, it was very important to have a worldview that is what we called scientific, a worldview that is scientific, that tended to make you associate with, the underprivileged of the world, even in your own country, the poor in your own country, the underprivileged classes, and which try to explain that these things, because they are created by human beings, they could be overcome by human beings. That because there are things that happen in history, then they could also be overcome in history. Of course, I think that is what also colored the thinking, the outlook of a good number of leaders in the RPF. But I would say that RPF was like a compromise in ideological terms, because there are Marxists, there are others who didn't have any kind of ideological pretenses, and who simply said, basically our problem is, to solve the problem of refugees, let's go back home. But for me and a very good number of leaders in RPF, they tended to share this kind of ideological line. Now, today, I do not subscribe to some of the Marxist tenets, like saying that everything is about class struggle, that we are ordained to have classes fighting each other for the control of the state. I no longer subscribe to the idea that in order to be truly revolutionary, you have to subscribe to the idea that there's no God, because I now believe in God. I no longer believe that this whole utopian view of saying that, the state would ultimately fade away, because that's also what we believed in as Marxists, that they fade, that in the final contest between socialism and capitalism, the victory of socialism will make sure that at some point, once the proletariat have controlled the state, the working class has controlled the state, ultimately the state would disappear. I mean, these are some of the things that we used to think about, and the fundamental tenets of Marxism. So these are some of the things that I no longer subscribe to. But the human mind is such that it will not always hold one thing or the other. They are not mutually exclusive. It is such that since I was born and I was introduced to knowledge, your mind keeps on accommodating this or that, accommodating that or this. And that's how the human brain works. So it's not that once you have a new idea, that every other previous idea is going to be ejected out of your brain. there is an element of synthesis, but some of the things that I believe in now, I have simply stated them in the book. But I think Marxist philosophy at that age was very, very exciting for me and very absorbing, and I think in no less terms, it does influence, we even without knowing, how you look at the world, how you look at your country, how you analyze phenomenon. And I think it's not only Marxist philosophy, and the fact that I have also spent a huge chunk of my life in sciences, studying science and studying medicine and all that, it gives you probably a way to analyze events and situations that sometimes comes close to even what Marxist philosophy teaches. And so I think it's a very interesting development, one's growth, to see what we go through, our thinking, and having come to where I am right now.
The desire to return to Rwanda when you were with Kagame and the RPF, and before that when you were living in Uganda and in Kenya, is that the same desire that you have now as a founder of the RNC? And did that same desire to return home, did that kind of re-spark in you and help jumpstart the RNC?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually discussed this with many, many Rwandans, both during the pre-RPF days, RPF days, and now during our time. Rwanda is a very interesting idea, I should call it, because if you look at Rwanda on the map, you look at its size, you look at its problems, you look at the problems that it has gone through in history up to now, you would otherwise think that if you were to escape from Rwanda, and in fact, for the first 5 years since I left Rwanda in 2004-2005, I actually did entertain the idea that, you know what, I have given all that I could give to Rwanda during my youthful years. I have done everything that I possibly could do to be part of changing the country. I look at myself at my age, I say, you know what, I'm going also, and I describe that in the book. I said, you know, let me be selfish for the first time. Let me fend for my family and forget about this whole thing about Rwanda. But Rwanda is very intriguing, and that's why I said that I simply call it an idea beyond the hills, beyond the geography, beyond the history. Because it's only when you feel that you've lost Rwanda that your appetite for Rwanda grows exponentially. It's when you feel that you've lost Rwanda, you've been alienated from Rwanda, you cannot go back as you should. It's when you lose it that the craving, it's like a craving, it's like an addiction. That's how I'm trying to describe it myself, how I feel it within me. That it's when you lose it that you feel that the only thing worth fighting for, even the only thing worth dying for, is actually Rwanda. And I've seen this on the face of many Rwandans that I've met in these last 2 years during the RNC work. And it's precisely the same type of craving that I can remember that we had in Kampala, in Nairobi, many people had in Burundi, in Brussels, in Tanzania, in America, that craving for Rwanda. And I think it's a very unique craving, but probably we do share it with other people who simply run into exile. But it is particularly very, very strong within me. It's very, very strong amongst the Rwandans that I have seen. And that's why I really think that as Rwandans, as this generation, we must put our heads together and see how we can end once and for all this question of being exiled. Because strange ideas develop during exile. Radical ideas do develop within the refugee communities. During exile, that's when sharp distinctions become very, very clear about Hutus and Tutsis. That's when you can no longer deal with all these problems through political means, that's when people start thinking about taking up arms against the government of the day. And so I think it's this craving for Rwanda is absolutely, crushing, if I may use the word, once you begin to have it. And it's the only thing that, one of the things that drives, people day and night, and they have sacrificed everything they have. They have to set aside whatever they are doing for survival in order to be part of that movement of regaining what you think you have lost. So it's a very, very powerful idea.
I want to ask about Fred Rajima. You spoke about his death and how you learned about it, and that the mystery surrounding his death still pretty much is a mystery at this point. Had Fred lived and continued to lead the invasion from the north back into Rwanda, how do you think the process of returning home would have been different from the way that Kagame led the rebellion after Fred died?
Yeah, these are the frequent what ifs in history. What if, so and so had not died, what would have happened? What if Idi Amin had not become the president of Uganda? What if Hitler had not suffered from a severe winter and his campaign into Russia had succeeded? What would have happened? And sometimes I do ask myself, and we do ask ourselves this question: what if General Rugema had lived? How would have the modern history of Rwanda have turned out? Of course, we cannot answer that question. Or even what if President Juvenal Habyarimana had not been killed in 1994. The point that you make, that the actual death of Rugema remains mysterious. There are many people, I'm sure, Jenny, you've talked to many people who feel that one way or the other, either Kagame was involved in his killing, or Bayingana Dibonyenyezi might have been involved in his killing. There are so many theories, and especially, in situations where the DRPF did not come out clean from the very beginning to explain the circumstances, that tended to fuel all these conspiracy theories. As I've said, personally, I've also had many of these conspiracy theories about who might have been responsible for General Rugema's death. The verdict that I come close to accepting, because I've not carried out my own investigation and I wasn't there, it is that General Rugema may have died because he was a special person, because he was a very charismatic general, a very charismatic leader, who tended to lead his people from the front. He never asked people to do what he could not do himself. And because of that, especially on a very critical beginning of an enterprise like this one, dangerous enterprise like that one, the invasion, Fred Rugema wanted to set a very good example, and was ahead of his soldiers, and most likely indeed he may have died from the enemy and in a fire. Now, of course, there are many people who think that it might have been otherwise. But had Rwigema survived, as I said in the book, I didn't have the privilege and the honor to know General Rwigema personally. I have heard about him through other people. But I summarize in the book that he was a very unique guy, a very good man, somebody who tries to forge consensus amongst his followers, somebody who tries to, who is very, very tolerant, a uniting factor. And so some of these things are precisely the qualities that his successor, General Kagame, did not have. General Kagame has never been the guy who leads his soldiers from the far front. He does lead through fear and coercion and force from the rear, and very often actually from the comfort of the rear. This is the reality that we saw during the struggle. Kagame is a very polarizing guy, whereas General Rwigema was a uniting person. Kagame is a guy with dictatorial tendencies to control and coerce. That's how he instills fear, and therefore he rules through fear. So I believe that had General Rwigema lived, from what I've heard from people who knew him, it is possible that maybe his calm demeanor and the fact that he sought consensus, he could be uniting, maybe a negotiation with the government might have been more realistic, and maybe it would have set the course on having an element of compromise. Having gained military success, maybe he would have compromised and made a deal with the then government of Rwanda, and maybe something might have worked. But all these are hypotheses. We do not know. The only one thing that we know is that General Rwigema was remarkably different from Kagame. He was a uniting factor. He sought consensus. He was charismatic. He was tolerant. And he had a large heart. Remember, a large heart is a precondition for being a successful leader. Anybody who thinks that anyone who is not like you should be banished, and in the case of Kagame, anybody who is not like him, who does not talk like him, who does not believe in what he's doing, is an enemy, and that enemy must die. General Rwigema was very much different from him. Had he lived, probably the modern history of Rwanda would have been different. But once again, these are what ifs of history, so we cannot know exactly what would have happened.
Mm-hmm. You write that sharing power has historically been the most difficult thing to do in Rwanda. Do you think that this mentality can ever change? As an outside observer, I see this a lot in the opposition parties to the RPF, where there's little to very few groups that want to work together for the same change that they all want. With roughly 25, I believe, opposition parties, it seems that working together for a common goal would be more productive than 25 separate parties. So how can this concept of power sharing in Rwanda be overcome for a common goal or for the common good?
Yeah, good question. You're absolutely right, Jennifer, because in fact, I do dwell on that question, because we have two sets of problems in Rwanda. If you remember, I said that one of the diseases that we have is a disease that afflicts the whole society. In fact, I have coined the term for no better description that I could find of. I've called it RAIDS, the autoimmune disease syndrome, only that it's raids, and I simply compare Rwanda to a person where there is failure in the internal system for the components of the system to recognize each other as part of the same self, the part of the same body, because if Rwanda was the body, then all of us are components. In order for Rwanda to continue to exist as one body, we must recognize each other as part of the same body. That's self-recognition. Now, that has broken down. That is why, you know, these killings that have taken place, you've had, you know, people killing each other. Hutus killing Hutus. Hutus killing Tutsis. Tutsis killing Hutus. Tuas killing, you know, people. So it's chaos. It's like an autoimmune self-destruction that has been going on in our society for quite some time. That is one disease that afflicts the whole body called Rwanda. And it applies to me, to everyone who is Rwandan, because even when you go out, like we have in these last 2 years, and you talk to Rwandans, you get the impression that they would only be satisfied and happy if the other side was condemned to be second-class citizen and punished and thrown into exile so that they too can suffer. You know, this is, every time you talk to people, if you talk to a Tutsi, they will tell you how terrible the Hutus are. You talk to these Hutus and they tell you how these Tutsis are terrible. And so even when unspoken, and often sometimes they tell you, most often they don't, you will see that our society has a problem. So that is one set of problems. But the second set of problems, which relatively tries to answer your question, is one of the Rwandan elite who are addicted to power. And because of that addiction to power, when they are out of it, they really scramble to get this power. When they need, they hold on to it, even to the point of death. And so this question of sharing power, by the way, generally speaking, it's a power throughout history. It's not a Rwandan phenomenon or an African phenomenon or European or American. It's a general human phenomenon.
That's
people
true.
Want to have
yeah.
power. People want to have power, and they want to have absolute power. In fact, somebody has said the only consistent thing throughout history is for people to want to have power and to use that power for their own advantage. Freedom, on the other hand, is not a very consistent thing throughout history. The history of empires and that have risen and fallen, it's not freedom. It rather points to the aggressive appetite that human beings have for power, not sharing it, but holding it. And so, the Rwandans, therefore, the Rwandan elite, whether Hutu or Tutsi, we have this problem of wanting power and wanting power at the expense of others. And once we get it, very often, of course, through violent means, we want to cling on to it, even the point of death, even to the point of self-destruction. Because if you look at the Rwandan elite who ruled Rwanda before the revolution of 1959, where they were more or less demolished. The Rwandan elite of 1959 revolution, where they demolished. The elite who presided over the MLND system, where they demolished in exile or languishing in Arusha. And right now, the elite, the Tutsi elite and a few Hutu collaborators who work with them to maintain the system, they want to convince everyone that actually this time, this is to stay and stay forever. But that's absolutely untrue. It's not possible that it will last forever, especially, in fact, dangerously too, especially since this is even a minority. All elite in Rwanda have tended, even when they have been Hutu, they've been a minority, but particularly this one is a minority within a minority. And so the idea of sharing power is a disease that you see among the elite in power and outside power. And that's why you are describing the phenomenon that you see amongst the opposition groups. They are the same building blocks. They are the same elite. And the question which you ask, shall we be able to overcome it? Yes, we shall be able to overcome it, but it's going to be a long and difficult process, especially since there is no precedent. But the precedents that we can look at is what happens in other parts of the world, even in some parts of Africa, even amongst our neighbors. Look at what has happened in Burundi. It's not a perfect solution. They are not completely out of danger, but I would say they are ahead of us. Look at what is happening in Tanzania. What has happened in Tanzania? You would say, oh, Chama Cha Mapinduzi is a strong party, has been there for all the time. But look, there is a bit of competition within the CCM, and there is a minimum of tolerance within the Tanzanian system. Even when you look at what is going on in Kenya and Uganda, and you go down southern Africa, in parts like Botswana, the Zambias, the South Africa, you go to West Africa in Ghana, and then of course in other parts of the world. Remember, the political development is not uniform across the world and in history. Each country goes through its own trajectory of development. But I would say, by and large, if we could have leaders, elites, who could at least understand that there is going to be a compromise, and then they try to encourage that, encourage the tolerance that comes with it, consensus building within it, within the whole democratic experience, because once again, democracy itself is a very big challenge for Rwanda, like it is for every nation. But I would say that if we could have leaders who have large hearts that can embrace all the components of the Rwandan society, and then try to cultivate this culture of rule by institutions and rule of law, and then try to encourage other components of society to recognize that we too, other than beyond the government, that we too as a society, we are sick and that we need to heal ourselves. Then over a period of time, in another 30, 50, 100 years, we may begin to see a culture of peaceful coexistence, of rule by institutions, rule by law. And it's this that also try to encourage the idea that in politics you need to negotiate outcomes rather than have them by decree and through absolute power. So it's a very difficult challenge, Jennifer. I'm not underestimating it, but it's one that is doable, and it's one that is difficult but achievable in the long term, as long as we begin investing in it. It's not automatic. It won't happen simply by chance and through the passage of time. But I think we begin investing in it, three by three, we should be able to see some of the outcomes that we've seen in other parts of the world.
In preparation for this interview, I put out a request for questions on Twitter and on Facebook. And I did get a few of those questions in, so I'm going to kind of jump to those. I have over 50 questions, and I can see we're not going to get to probably about half of those questions. So I'm going to jump to some of these email questions of listeners who wanted to ask you a few things. The first one is, at what point precisely did Dr. Rudasingwa realize he could not work for the RPF anymore? Also, did he have to escape Rwanda like General Kayumba did, or did he simply get on a plane and never return?
I describe it in the book. The divorce from the RPF came slowly. I didn't get on a plane and didn't come back, because and didn't escape just like Kayumba or Karegeya or Gahima, I'm talking about my immediate colleagues. There are so many other people who have escaped Rwanda, ministers, prime ministers, speakers of the National Assembly. There are so many people who have escaped. I didn't escape. In a way, I negotiated my own exit, and of course, it put me into trouble. But to answer the question, two parts. Number one, it happened over a period of time, but the kind of question that you've read in the book, for those who've read the book, they know that it's a long period of self-realization, of introspection, of looking at oneself, looking at the ideas that the RPF had and what was existing, looking at my own situation, my own ideas, what I stand for in life. So it happened over a long period of time, up to the time when but by the time I was leaving Rwanda, clearly I knew when finally Kagame gave me permission to leave the country, and I boarded a plane with my wife, having my children ahead of me in Kampala. I knew for sure I was not going back to Rwanda, and it is something that Kagame realized rather too late. I think he never knew that probably when he gave me permission and I left at that point in time, that I wasn't coming back. In fact, proof of that is when I was in California, he must have arrived in Kigali. People must have told that, you know, Theogene is out of the country, his wife is out of the country, his children are not at Green Hills today. I think Kagame must have panicked, and that's why I describe in the book he called me when I was in California, and why he would tell me that if I have anything to say or any grievances, that we should discuss them when I come back. So it is something that took place over a period of time, but then knowing how the system works, knowing how Kagame's vindictiveness, how far it can go, that is what all of us who, and what the people, even who are in the RPF today, leaders whom we know, that's the dilemma that they face. If you distance yourself from the system, the stakes are extremely high, and death is a very, very real possibility. If not death, it's being put in jail, or if not, you have to decide to go into exile. So you cannot distance yourself from the system and remain within Rwanda. Rwanda is a very small place. The system is so intrusive in people's lives, even to the, you know, the ordinary guy on the hill somewhere in the commune. And so somebody like me or any person who has acted at a national level, you simply cannot distance yourself from the system and remain within Rwanda. So yes, it came over a long period of time, but seeing the dangers of the system, I started not seeing them. We all somehow knew Kagame's excesses and his dictatorial traits, even during the struggle. But I think looking at the system and seeing how it's really going astray, it's something that I started seeing 98, 99, 2000. And of course, by the time we went for the general election 2003, as I described in the book, clearly I could see that the system had gone astray. I knew at some point I would leave, but the question remained, how would I leave without... And remember, this time it was not only Theogene as during the RPF days. This time it was Theogene and five other people. I had a family, I have a wife, I have four children. So you simply do not act like I acted before I joined the RPF. There are so many things to consider. So it came over a period of time, and I think Kagame himself knew that he too is a guy who wants to read other people's minds, just as I was reading his, he was reading mine.
Interesting. As I was reading the book, and especially about your interactions with Kagame working under him, I wondered As a medical doctor yourself, did you see any of these kind of mental neuroses he has? I mean, he appears to me, and from what I've read and spoken with people and talked with, he's for one, very paranoid. He sleeps very little. And like you said, he wants to read other people's minds. He wants to know what everyone's doing. An example of that in your book would be where he, on the phone, asked you about something your wife, Dorothy, had said while in Rwanda, and he wanted to know what she had said and if it was true that she had said it. And I thought, why would a head of state care what somebody's wife had said? You know, it wasn't as if she was giving a public address. But his desire to control and manipulate is very well versed in this book. So my question, sorry, it took a long ways to get there, was as a medical doctor, did you see this in him early on, or was it only until 98, 99, as you just said, where you started to realize this wasn't going to be what you thought it was?
No, in 99, 2000, I was, as soon as we got into Kigali, as you read in the book, 94, 95, we had, the preoccupation with survival, how we get the government running, and then immediately I came to Washington D.C. So I was out of the country at a critical time, 3.5 years that were very critical. Those early stages, especially within Rwanda, and so by the time I came back, I was just, these are things that you, having been the Secretary General of the RPF, having known how it operated and how I saw the kind of things that were visible to the eye, these are the general visible things to the eye that you could see. But it's only the 4 years that I have worked with Kagame as his chief of staff, first when he was vice president and then when he had his bloodless coup. I even wonder how bloodless, but certainly it was a bloodless coup against President Pastor Bizimungu, and I continued the job as chief of staff. The 4 years I worked with Kagame really gave me an insight into Kagame's personality that probably most other people may not even have, because I ran his office. I ran the office of the president. I was privy to what went on in his own household. But, I haven't been the one to describe, the household staff, what Kagame and his wife, what goes on in state household is. I mean, that is really their business. What I have tended to comment on are things that touch on the lives of Rwandans. It's not that I don't know much. It's not that I don't know much about Kagame's private life on trips or private life in his own household, but it is simply because that's not my business, and I will never be deflected from having this consistent line as to what I talk about. Now, it really gave me an insight into Kagame, and that is why I really, even in meetings increasingly with the international community and with Rwandans, we are alerting people to the fact that they need to pay more and more attention to the personality of Kagame, because that type of personality drives a lot of things that Kagame does, and especially to drive the kind of risks that he takes without even contemplating the consequences of some of these actions. And I will mention a few of them. But I first wanted to say that, as you rightly put it, Kagame is terribly paranoid. He truly, truly sees enemies everywhere. But guess what? Indeed, if you've been responsible for so many deaths and you've used other people to cause those deaths, I see why, for example, Kagame should be paranoid. It's because he sees that all the people that he has killed, at some point or another, maybe these people, one of them is going to also want to do something as bad as killing another person, that is killing him, killing Kagame himself. So that's why, number one, he's paranoid. Number two, he's a deeply insecure guy. He's a deeply insecure person. There is absolutely no amount of money. I mean, Kagame rules like an ancient emperor who feels that the wealth of the country is his own wealth. And it's not the purpose. I've not even gone deeply into that in the book. I think it will be treated in another book in the near future, how his financial empire. But even with all that wealth, you cannot imagine how Kagame micromanages the fund, the resources of the country. Just to give you an example, it's a very good example. Kagame would want sometimes, whenever people ask for permission to go outside, to travel abroad, like a government official, ministers, directors, division chiefs, all these people, they have to ask for what they call ordre de monsieur, is for permission to travel. And it's essentially Kagame who gives that permission. And sometimes I would be surprised because I would prepare all that my staff. I had a staff for almost over 100 people, and there were some who are charged for preparing to summarize something like that. But I would always be surprised. Sometimes somebody would want to go, and then I would recommend that he goes, and Kagame would refuse. As the president, of course, he has the final word. And I would be surprised. Sometimes I would go to his office, would have a calculator looking at this person who probably should spend like 3 or 4 days outside, and the president is busy calculating whether the guy stated that he's 400 instead of, rather 500 instead of 300. Mm. A whole head of state calculating an additional 200 that should have gone to somebody like that. So no amount of money will make Kagame secure. No amount of power, because he has absolute power, but he still would like to have all that. And the one source of insecurity that many people have talked about is that maybe because he does not have high education, university education, that makes him insecure. But look, there are so many successful leaders who've never gone to university. You do not need to have university education to feel secure, to feel confident, to have trust in people, and to do what you think is right. But certainly that might be part of the problem that Kagame has. But he's a very deeply insecure person. He's very paranoid, and he's a control freak. He wants to micromanage everything in the country. And part of the problem is that Rwanda has is that he has that character flaw that allows him to read into even simple things, signals that somebody is being disloyal or is being an enemy, like I describe in the book. Part of my tribulation, what I had was how he read into that whole thing about, you know, construction and say that I was disobedient to the commander-in-chief. I mean, this is something you would not expect from a head of state. Or even that mm-hmm. example you gave about my wife. Why would a president complain that my wife said something? I wasn't with my wife. My wife says she didn't say it. And as I said, suppose even she said it. If she described Rwanda as a backward country, why should I worry? Why should Kagame worry? Rwanda is not mine. Rwanda is not Kagame's. And you saw all those stories in the book where he would say, you know, go and tell so and so to distance himself from his wife because the wife does not like us. All these are things that show character flaws. But the one most important character flaw that Kagame has that has caused so much suffering to Rwandans and will continue, and which the international community and Rwandans need to know, because it's an addiction, it's not likely to stop on its own, he can only be stopped, and that is the addiction to kill people. I've described him as a serial killer. Mm-hmm. He behaves like a serial killer who has to get one victim after the other, after the other, after the other. That will not stop on its own. I think Rwandans have a responsibility to stop it.
Mm-hmm. I understand we have a caller. Caller, your last four digits are 5433. Do you have a question for Dr. Rudasingwa?
Yes. Thank you. My name is Mujambere Erika from Rwanda. I'm in the USA and Arizona. I just tell everybody who hear me from Rwanda, every Rwanda and where the people speak in Rwanda, God bless them. And the question you are talking about the conflict of Congo and the political of Rwanda and the political of Congo, it's for me, I have an opinion, it's a very important or necessary to make a dialogue between the rebels, all those rebels. They speak in Rwanda. They are the Rwandese people since the history of Rwanda or the history of Africa. So my opinion is to make a dialogue better than to make a conflict, because when we see our country has been being in a politics but which can give the opportunity to the population. So I just asking the union or the national unions or United Nations or the other countries, foreign countries, to sit down and talk to the Rwandese people, especially those people who are in Congo, because the problem we have now is the problem of Congo, where they are, those Rwandans with guns or with weapons, and those are those who still make trouble to the Congolese, to the people from Congo. So we just need to have a dialogue or diaspora so we can see how we can figure out, but especially with those foreign country, because that's where it is very important to think about those foreign countries and those relationship with them, because I don't think ourselves as Rwanda or as Congo people, we can ourselves make any change. We need support, especially for those foreign countries. But the dialogue is more important. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not sure that, I don't think there was a question in there. For you, Doctor.
I think the speaker raises two. If I heard him correctly, number one, he says there should be dialogue between and among Rwandans and Congolese people, including rebel groups. I entirely agree with him that there has to be a dialogue between the peoples of Congo and Rwanda and Burundi and Tanzania and Uganda, but particularly with regard to the problem of Congo. I entirely agree with him that there has to be the dialogue amongst all these exiled communities or Congolese in diaspora, Rwandan in diaspora. There has to be dialogue as a way of not only ending the present conflicts in our region, but also of tapping into the opportunities that do exist in our region when we work together and when we work through dialogue rather than through conflict. But of course, we know there are spoilers. There are spoilers within Congo itself, and there are spoilers from Rwanda. And whether these spoilers can be convinced to stop on their own, that's another matter. But one thing I must say is that we as Congolese people and Rwandan people and people in the region have the responsibility and the challenge to see that we work towards ending the problems in Rwanda and ending the problems in Congo and working together to make sure that one country does not cause problems into import problems into the other, like Rwanda has imported problems into Congo. And so the board is now caught as Rwandan people, as Congolese people, to struggle to have change in our countries. The second part of the question, he's talking about the role of foreigners and how we cannot solve the problems alone, how we should seek the support of the international community. Again, I agree with him, except to add that when it comes to Rwanda and it comes to Congo, foreigners have also been a source of problems. If you look at the history of Rwanda that I describe in my book, you look at the role of the colonial authorities, the Germans, the Belgians, the role of Belgium during the First Republic, the role of France during the Second Republic of Habyarimana, the role of the Americans and the British with the RPF and the Kagame regime, the role of the United Nations, the role of Uganda, you know, that you can see that, yes, Rwandans cause problems to each other, but very often those problems are actually made bigger and made more complicated and difficult to solve because of the role of foreigners. I cannot even come to talk about the role of foreigners in Congo because, in the case of Congo, mm-hmm. because of its mineral wealth, its natural resources, when foreigners look at Congo, they don't see Congolese people. They simply say they see coltan, they see diamond, mm-hmm. they see gold, they see the forest, they see, and they start surveying. That's why the aggressive appetite of foreigners in getting resources of Congo has been also a problem for Congo as well. So when we say that foreigners, that we need the support of foreigners, we need to take it with a pinch. We need to look at it in a very balanced way, in a two-step process. Number one, we must realize that the interest of Rwandans and the interest of the Congolese people are paramount, first and foremost. And around that, it is us Rwandans and the Congolese people to define these interests and how to champion them and how to defend them. That's number one. Number two, because we also need foreigners, and foreigners need us, we need to negotiate. We need to negotiate with them and say, support us in ABC. Then if you support us in ABC, then we shall work with you for you to get ABC. Because that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. The Americans, the British, the French, the Belgians are not in Congo's philanthropists. They do not come to Rwanda's philanthropists. It's at the end of the day, commercial interests, economic interests, security interests are first and foremost what they call their national interests is what drives all these countries. And so we need to define our own national interests and then compare notes with their national interests. And then have a meeting place where we say, okay, support us in this, then you can also get us that. We can get you that. That's how the world should operate under normal circumstances. But to go blindly, saying that, we want to do this, and so the British and the Americans and the French and the Belgians and I don't know who else are going to support it, that's a very naive way of looking at national interests or looking at the international situation. The person who said that all these countries do not have permanent enemies, they do not have permanent friends, they only have permanent interests. And I think that captures what drives all these countries into our region and into our countries.
Mm-hmm. I understand we have another caller. Caller 1111. Do you have a question for Dr. Rudasingwa?
Hello.
Caller, are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead and ask your question.
My name is Didis.
Good evening, Didis. Go ahead and ask your question.
I think I should first thank you. I said my name is Ilias, and I should first thank you for this show, and I should thank Dr. Lusingo for his book. Unfortunately, I should first make a confession that I haven't read his book, and actually, I did order it from Amazon. I haven't yet got it in my library, and I'm eagerly waiting for it. But I've just got a bit of what is in the book. But even though I haven't read the book, I think I would have some very few questions for my good friend Dr. Lusingo. One is that we have read a little literature on post-conflict societies and how they do overcome their past tragedies, and that's the central theme of Dr. Lusingo's book. But in the women's context, we have a bipolarity that has been going on, actually, as we did explain in his book, that has been going on, even though I haven't read it, but I have read some previews. He's talking about a bipolarity that has been going on since, actually, before independence and up to now that is still going on. And the question is, how does he propose? I haven't read his book fine, but I just wanted him to tell us in very simple terms how he thinks this bipolarity could end. Just very few steps, 1, 2, 3, and we end up and we do away with this bipolarity of fearing the other, of having the bipolarity of the Tutsi seeing the Hutus as the enemy, or the Hutu seeing the Tutsi as the enemy. And number two, I would wish, if you have time, to tell us what has been his role. I need to rewind this question back to 1990 when the LPF launched a guerrilla war against the then regime, and one of the main points was the restoration of national unity and conciliation. And the regime was part of the struggle, and up to when he left the country, I happened to have followed him, and I would say that he had some influence and some power, and I just want to know where his efforts got to the bottom, what he did when he was in the country, when he had influence, and who really betrayed him. Was he in sort of trying to promote an ethnic dialogue, an ethnic balance that we really should envisage in tomorrow's Rwanda? Because I remember him, I happened to have followed his activities back in Rwanda, and I really do treasure his work, and I did treasure his contribution, but I don't happen to have been very, very privy to what he did advise his president then. I like I said before, I haven't yet read the book, but I would just want to know what his proposal to the president were, such as that we really, the Rwandan people or the people listening to him now have confidence in him, that if the Rwandese now say that, Mr. President, why you have really put up a very good work, and now we trust you with the safety of the nation, we have put our lives, everything in Rwandese, into your hands, that you can guide us to where we really want to be, that you can guide us to a nation where we don't have this plurality, where we don't see ourselves as one against the other. And third, if you allow me, the host, I would ask Dr. Lusingo if in the present political context in Rwanda, and actually in the region, there is a flaw of the political balance we are fighting in Kenya, where what you call democracy is actually turning it out to be a tyranny of the majority. A group that has got the majority captures power, and how do you reconcile that tyranny of the majority that you call democracy vis-a-vis the ethnic balance we have in Rwanda, the Tutsis versus the Hutus? How do we open up a democratic space in a state that has 20% of the people who vote an ethnic group and who view ethnic group or ethnic identity as a passport to capture power? And I'm asking this because there's one of the arguments that has actually been forwarded by so many political observers in Rwanda and actually beyond Rwanda, who actually disagree with them, is that it is not really logical to open up political space because democracy is yet to grow in our societies where people view themselves as in terms of ethnic belonging rather than national belonging. Those were just my few questions. As I look forward to receive a very good book by my good friend, Dr. Jim Dasingwa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you get all that, Dr. Rudasingwa?
I got the gist of it, and actually they are very, very, they are excellent questions. It's only that, number one, I would have loved the person who did ask these questions to have read the book, because I do dwell some time, and by the way, what I write in my book, I mean, these are not prescriptions like, you know, this is the medicine, Rwanda, take it. If you don't take it, then you're in trouble. I think if there's one thing that my whole experience has taught me by now is to be very modest about your prescriptions and to be very humble about what you think your ideas can do for society, because I think we've seen how time and again Rwandans have been promised lofty goals and lofty ideas, only to be disappointed. So I have learned to. So it's my thinking. Some of them are thinking that I share with my colleagues in RNC and other Rwandans. But there are other places where I do take what I believe in, and as the basis of what I do. The first question which he asked is about the prescription for how to resolve the bipolarity. Listeners who are listening to that may not, some of them, either because of language or other reason, may not probably fully understand what bipolarity is. But he described it as this thing that is cyclical between Hutus and Tutsis, and that's the basis of really of what I describe in the book, that we've now gone through two revolutions, one Hutu, the other Tutsi, but the status quo has remained. In other words, we've become a society of victors, and I call it the losers and winners, and then victims and perpetrators. That is the cycle that we've been in for a long time, and we keep on changing positions, but that situation has remained. And he's asking, how do we overcome that? And part of the answer to that is actually, first of all, we must be truthful to each other. We must realize that we have a problem. Because if you go to see a doctor and you try to pause and pretend before a doctor, and the doctor asks you, oh, what is your problem? And you tell the doctor, doctor, I have no problem. I don't think that the doctor will be able to help you. Whatever and a specialist this doctor might be, if you do not have an insight into your own problem, there is absolutely nothing that the doctor is going to do for you. So first, the first process in treating yourself, in healing yourself, in overcoming any problem in life, is self-awareness. Yes, you must be aware of your problem, have an insight into your see what you can do for yourself and what others can do for you. And so the first step in Rwandan society is that's what I said earlier to a question that Jennifer, you asked me. I said the elite, which controls power, whether Hutu or Tutsi, through in different times, is addicted to power. And this power is absolute. It's not shared power. It's very often captured in the name of the grievances of an ethnic group. 1959 revolution, it was about the grievances of the Hutu. In 1990, to the grievances of the Tutsi. But when it is captured, it is really a power of the elite, a very small group of people. At any one point when I was part of this establishment, sometimes you would count the number of people who truly, truly Kagame would call for meetings to discuss an important issue. Very often he would have taken even a decision before he calls you, but those he calls in the kitchen cabinet, very often they are not more than 10 people. And they are mostly military guys, because Rwanda is effectively really a military dictatorship. And so the addiction to power by the elite, and number two, the problem that within society, beyond the state, even members of society, ourselves, are sick because they cause problems to each other. They hit each other. But certainly the state and the elite who govern are instrumental in that they have an interest in members of society behaving the way they behave. It's the usual thing of divide and rule. And so the first step really is a recognition of the problem that we have at the power of the elite who capture the state and at the power of society itself. The other things, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there are 7 things that I mentioned in the book, including truth-telling, including the issue of forgiveness, the issue of how to enhance freedom through institutions, and many other things. But, the first step is that where we need to recognize that the problem that we have. Can we overcome the divisions of in our society? Yes, we can. We can overcome these divisions, but it's going to take an enlightened leadership and enlightenment within society.
Mm-hmm.
Enlightened leadership, enlightenment within society, and that goes to educational institutions, to faith-based organizations, to what we do in communities, what we do within all sorts of institutions. So there are so many things that we need to do, and they are discussed within the book. That is one. Number two, he asked about what role I had in promoting reconciliation within Rwanda itself on behalf of the RPF. Honestly, many of us, in our youthful years, we truly believed in RPF's philosophy that, and that's also partly the influence of the Marxist philosophy, of saying that, this whole thing of Hutus and Tutsis was a creation by the colonial authorities to divide and rule. Number two, it's a class thing, because when Hutus and Tutsis are part of the ruling establishment, or when they are rich, they have fewer contradictions amongst each other. That is partly true. But let me tell you one thing, which I know for sure, which I know is very strong within RPF, even when they don't say it, which is very strong even outside here, where we do community work amongst Rwandans in the diaspora. The issue of ethnic identity is very, very strong. And has become even more complicated and stronger because people have died because of their ethnic identity. And people have captured power and used it against a particular ethnic identity. So questions of power are very much mixed up with issues of ethnic identity. And so, but the RPF in the public could say, we've overcome. I recently had a bishop who said, we've achieved reconciliation up to a tune of about 80%. The other remaining 20% we shall achieve in the shortest possible time. That's a lie. The fact of the matter is that even when I was part of the establishment, when Kagame called the kitchen cabinet and all of us were military guys, we were all Tutsi. And we had a preoccupation of thinking how we could survive in a sea that is populated by Hutu. So in during the day, Kagame and us would be talking about all these things, but the fact of the matter was that this is a regime where you have a tiny minority within an ethnic minority. And that kind of minority tends to rely on force, on coercion, on brutality in order to survive. So the answer to whether I promoted reconciliation, I genuinely believed in that philosophy at another stage within the RPF. But with time, I started seeing the dangers of not accepting that we are Hutu, we are Tutsi, we are Twa, and then figuring out how we can forge a true national Rwandan identity out of these diverse components, because that's also how other countries have done it. I think for now what I believe in is that we are Hutus and Tutsis and Twas, but so what? If we are Rwandans, then there should be something in common that we have, and there are things that we can build on, but it cannot be at the expense of saying we are not Hutu, there are no Hutus, there are no Twas, there are no Tutsis, we've banned the identity card. That's, I think, nonsense, because you only need to know what Kagame and the company discuss within their close quarters, and you need to interact with people here in the diaspora and see how comfortable they are being Hutu and Tutsi and Twa, but knowing what we've gone through in the past, what we can do together in order to continue to forge that true Rwandan identity, and I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
As for the third question regarding the dangers of democracy, yes, democracy is a very dangerous idea, and great, great things that have happened in life, in business, whether it's innovation, whether it's the work of entrepreneurs, people who built empires or built nations, Christianity or Islam or Buddhism, or all these are very, very profound but very disruptive ideas. And it's the same with democracy. Now, many people would argue that because Rwanda has this, and I've heard it from Kagame many, many times, even when I still worked with him, and cadres of RPF, saying, and by the way, you should listen to elites before they are in government, what they say, and try to listen to them when they're in government, because sometimes you get amused. I have listened to Kagame say, for example, that people should allow us to have our own democracy, our own pace, because they too have had their own pace. The Americans have had their own pace. The British system of government has evolved over centuries in its own way. The French way of democracy is different from the Scandinavians, and so on and so forth, or the Indian one, or the Canadian one.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, there are certain things that at least societies that are relatively well governed, there are certain things that they have to do. The problem with Rwanda, like compared to even Burundi, this issue of Hutus and Tutsis, the ethnic, the bipolarity that my friend is talking about, it is a true problem, I think. But what is the way around it? If you say that we cannot go have free and fair elections in Rwanda, because if we have free and fair elections, the Hutus will elect their own Hutu, then that is a problem. It is a problem, and you do not have the only alternative to that is dictatorship. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I say democracy is a dangerous proposal, is a dangerous idea, because it carries within its own womb certain risks. If you go the democratic way, then you must accept that at some point, Rwandans, even with their bipolarity, are going for elections, including to allow the Hutus to elect one of their own, if one of their own, by definition, is a Hutu. I think that's one of the problems that we face. But the question would be, if the Hutus elect their own a Hutu, isn't this Hutu supposed to be a president of all Rwandans? Isn't he supposed to be a president of Hutus and Tutsis and Twas? That is one question that we need to be thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, there are things, because of the nature of a society, that you cannot simply resolve through elections. If a society has gone through genocide and massive abuse of human rights, like in the case of Rwanda, the genocide against the Tutsis, massive human rights, even as some reports have said, possible acts of genocide against Hutu in Rwanda and Congo, pluralization within society, you cannot overnight say all the problems we shall get over with them through the elections. There are things that you need to sit at the table as a society and bargain, like the question of security institutions. You cannot subject that to elections. You are going to sit down, especially in a situation where you have an entire army, the officer corps being 100% Tutsi, and then of course the men being Hutu, as the case is in the majority Hutu, as the case is in Rwanda. That is not a sustainable thing. You would have to negotiate it. So you would also have to negotiate what my colleagues talks about, negotiate and make sure that the Hutus who have elected, at least for now, because it's possible, even in America, it has taken over 200 years for America to elect a black president.
Mm-hmm.
Things can change over a period of time if the institutions have been working and other components of society have been working. But in the case of Rwanda, you would have to make sure that you negotiate clauses within the constitution and the workings of the government to make sure that it does not become the tyranny of the of the majority,
mm-hmm.
so that it does not become the dictatorship of the majority Hutu. In short, that's what my colleagues was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So we shouldn't move from the dictatorship of one person, Kagame, and move into the dictatorship of the majority by making sure that some of the things, we negotiate them at a table. That's why I describe in my book a grand bargain. We need to have a grand bargain on security institutions, including the army, the police, the intelligence, some kind of clauses that really include certain affirmative action to make sure that the minority is not trampled upon, as was the case of the 1959 revolution or up to 1994, that the minority are not killed at will, as it has happened. So there are things that we have to accept, certain risks we have to take, because there's no shortcut to democracy. We, at some point, if political parties are allowed to function, at some point we shall go for hopefully free and fair elections, and that will include taking the risk that the Hutu, after once again, may be able to elect one of their own, and one of their own defined as one of the Hutu. But it is possible that in the future that might change. Hutus and Tutsis may elect a Tutsi, or Hutus and Tutsis may elect a Hutu. That will be a political majority, not an ethnic majority. And I think these are some of the risks that we can undertake. But for Kagame and IPF to say, oh, we democracy is dangerous, let's have democracy our own way. What they are describing, democracy their own way, is actually dictatorship. It's absolute power, because that's what exists in Rwanda today. So the three questions my colleagues are very pertinent. I don't think that we can exhaust them in this one conversation, but I do touch on some of them very briefly in my book, and I do propose a way forward.
Yeah, I do believe that should the caller read the book, he would find many of his answers there that he asked tonight. And it's interesting that he called in. If I'm correct, that was Dita Skasana, who was formerly of Umaseso. And I did have a few questions for you about Umaseso, but I can see that our time has... I'm not sure where you're at, Dr. Rudasingwa, as far as
no,
time...
No, It's okay. Go on.
Well, unfortunately, I still have about 35 questions.
So we cannot... We will have another session. I think we can schedule another session.
Yes, I think so too, but we do have a caller that's online. Would you be willing to answer the caller's question?
Sure.
Okay, caller 6655, you're on with Dr. Rudasingwa. Caller, are you there? I don't think the caller's with us. Caller, are you there? Okay, I guess he's not there. He's been on hold for a while. So how do you want to proceed, Dr. Rudasingwa? Do you want us to call it a night here, or do you want to take a couple more questions?
I mean, it's up to you. We cannot exhaust all the questions, but if we could take one or two more questions, and then we call it a night so that
you can retire. Okay.
Yeah,
I've got a group of 12-year-old girls downstairs having a birthday party. So my question, let me ask the question I had about Umaseso since Mr. Gasana did call in. And if he's listening, I'll be happy to send him my copy of the book if he wants to contact me, if he hasn't already ordered his. My question, you did talk about Umaseso, the newspaper publication that was in Rwanda while you were there. I believe the publication still remains suspended, and all of the writers are in exile also at this point. My question was, what role did Umaseso play in your reputation or in your decision to leave Rwanda? Did Umaseso have any effect on that?
No, not at all. I don't think that... Umaseso had any role in the departure from Rwanda. The editors of Umaseso have certainly suffered under the regime's hands, and they have consequently fled, and they are living in exile like myself.
Mm-hmm.
I do mention very briefly my conversation with President Kagame before I left Rwanda. I did mention how it was a very... I've never had a conversation with my colleagues in exile about this very matter, to know exactly how under pressure probably they were working, to sometimes do things that the state would coerce them to do. I don't really understand it. But clearly, and this one from other sources, I know that, and especially since what happened to my own brother, Gahima, which I describe in the book,
mm-hmm.
I particularly... And never understood why Umaseso really was on Gahima day in and day out. As I said, we've come to learn later, and we come to learn that very often, some people in the intelligence had a hand in having these stories in Umaseso. How that would have happened? When in fact the Umaseso were also victims of the same state, I've never come to understand it. And I think our friends who the editors of Umaseso would know better than myself. But I remember with my own situation, Kagame asked me whether I had seen a story in the Umaseso paper. I said, yes, I did. And I came to, you know, to, at that time I had read in Museso how, you know, Kagame builds and I'm the one who destroys. And I was intrigued. It was the night probably before I left, the first time in 2004, why Kagame would be raising this for me. If he and people like Ndahiro and other people within the president's office would not have been involved in something like that. So I don't know where the Museso people, they would know better where they got that story from. But he asked me, and I said, you know, as you read in the book, I said, most likely, the, you know, somebody within the president's office could might have provided this kind of information. And of course, for him, he quickly, you know, came in, which I considered mm-hmm. like a diversionary tactic. He said, oh, I think this Valens Kajegwoko, who is he was another PF guy who fought with the PF, so he lives here in the United States. He said that he knows that it's Valens Kajegwoko who he was like insinuating that he's the one who controls the Museso and gives them money or something like that. That's what he said, but I was looking at his face. I didn't particularly believe what he was telling me. He was more or less trying to hide his own hand and the hand of some of his people who probably might have found a way of getting the story into Museso. So, but particularly, as I said, I didn't like the way the witch hunt against Jared Gaima, my brother, because it went on and on and would go into the family, and I would say that really, without knowing Museso, caused so much anguish to my and sorrow to my own brother. And I don't think that it was fair, but I would leave that to the people of Museso. Maybe one time in history they will be able to comment on that affair.
I remember one time sitting with your brother, and he asked me if I thought the writers for Museso had regret for what they had done to him, your brother. And
I never knew, but I did.
Yeah.
I particularly really, I've never, they don't, maybe one day, you know, these brothers should also, I mean, we are always, you know, many times people want Teogen to come clean on radio. They want Kayumba to come and say the things we've done. They want Gaima. They want Karegeya. But I also think that all members of society, and that's part of the cleansing process that I talk about, the truth-telling process that I'm talking about. Because unless we confront these demons in our past and approach them with a view of talking about them so that we can overcome our own fears and our own prejudice, I'm very much afraid that even if you have regime change, society will remain stagnant in the old habits, and it will be a question of time when this same society goes back into the same problems. Because I really did not understand the justification of how these intelligence officers, how they sneaked all these stories into Museso, because I do not think that Museso was doing it on its own. So I don't know whether it was coercion, and I do not know whether it was the regime simply wanting to have its own ways. But whichever way, I think our brothers also need at some point to come and describe what was going on with the system and how, you know, members of society end up also being hurt in these kinds of ways. But many other people would say, oh, but Gaima was presiding over the justice system, which was also unfair and ended up hurting other people. That's another matter. I think when you have Gaima on radio, ask him these questions. ask him about these questions. I'm always asked all sorts of questions. So Kayumbi is always asked about, the human rights abuses that took place in Byumba and Ruhengeri during the insurgency, the RPF, crimes in Congo. We are always asked all these questions. So I think we need to be, story by story, we need to be comfortable to be able to be bold enough and courageous enough to talk about what we know, how the system, which is persecuting us, because clearly the system was persecuting Museso, was persecuting Umuvugizi, was persecuting every media that tried to take an independent line of informing the public, the Rwandan public. They were being persecuted. But how at some point they would turn up and do the things that the state wanted to do, that one I have never understood it.
Mm-hmm.
That one.
Yeah, I didn't have an answer, obviously, for Dr. Kahima, since I don't know the guys from Umuseso very well. But I thought it was a legitimate question that I hoped one day he'd get an answer to. I could tell in the way that he proposed the question to me that it was something that was hurting him quite deeply.
Yes, it was. And which hurt his family. Attacking
mm-hmm.
Teogeno Gahima is one thing, but when, you know, media goes into the really the details of you know, families, and that
mm-hmm.
is not fair. That's not fair, and I that's one of the things that we should be struggling to overcome, so that the media too becomes an instrument of healing, an
mm-hmm.
instrument of helping the truth come out, an
mm-hmm.
instrument of figuring out to build bridges so that people can forgive. That's the kind of media, and I think I don't go so much into it. I hope to develop some of these themes in my future book, but I see the media as an indispensable component of that healing process and healing
mm-hmm.
direction of Rwanda. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A powerful tool for that. I think that's probably where we'll end for tonight. Like I said, I do have 35 more questions for you.
No, thank you so much, Jennifer. I mean, we should be able to organize it. It's an ongoing conversation. I intend to,
yes.
in the next couple of months, to go from wherever I'm able, whether it's in Europe, in Africa, or here in the United States. Maybe one day I'll come to Denver also to continue these conversations. And by the way, even America needs to hear. So one of my... one of my future books will be How Can America Heal? Because it too is hurting.
Yes, it is. Yes, it
yes.
is. Well said. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time tonight, Dr. Kahima, and Dr. Rudasingwa, and for writing a really great book. I do hope all of our listeners and followers of the RNC and of interest in Rwanda will read your book, and I think that they would find it very insightful.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, and have a good night.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.